Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
And we came up with a proposal and a budget of approximately about $1.3 million, and we applied for a major grant to the National Endowment of the Humanities. And in 2010, we were given $750,000, and then we raised the other money from different foundations and fraternities and sororities, and we started pre-production in the fall of 2010. And then in 2011, in January through June, I went to Atlanta, I went to Alabama, I shot in New Jersey, I interviewed a lot of people you see in the film, David Levine Lewis, amongst others, and we shot in Alabama reenactments that you saw in the film, and we edited the film in the spring and summer of 2011, and it was on PBS in February 2012, and right before that, we were invited to the Sundance Film Festival. And you know, I've done lots of documentaries about African American history, from Eyes on the Prize to The Rise and Fall of Jim Crow, to a series called I'm Making a World with African American Artists. But I found this one to be one of the most important that I've ever done. And I think one of the things that makes this film stand out from among the other films I've done is that in this particular film, that you don't usually see in other historical documentaries, we had people who had descendants, who were descendants, both black and white, who were able to come on screen and sort of tell their family story and recognize, particularly the white descendants, the horrors of their ancestors. And it was in an interesting way sort of a turning point for the film, because initially I had made this with the idea of having descendants in the film. But through Doug's persistence and the persistence of our executive producer, Captain Allen, they persuaded me to interview some of these people, and I really think it really paid off. And I think this is a film that should be shown through schools, from middle school to university. I think it's a very important film, a very important part of American, I want to emphasize those two words, American history.
I just wanted to go back to my area of legal history. And so what happens in a country that's the most litigious country on the planet, in which we have lawsuits fulfilling McDonald's coffee in the lab, to anything else that could possibly happen, and we have attorneys to do all of those things. Sometimes we don't look at the role of law or the so-called rule of law. Some of you younger people will be going on to law school. You might have those plans, you might know other people in your lives, you know, the teachers who are lawyers, or maybe you have that aspiration. But the practice of law is one thing, the role of law in oppression is another. And what we see throughout your film is how the laws were changed and manipulated, how the court system was manipulated in order to get these people to be imprisoned in the first place. So the 13th Amendment has in it that caveat, except for conviction. And so then the black codes were put in place that were referred to, and those were the codes for loitering and trespass, et cetera. But consider this. After slavery ended and families had been torn apart, you're looking for your loved ones. So you may be traveling from Alabama to Georgia by foot in search of, so you might be stopping at a cabin here and there, having seen my daughter. She was about this tall, and the last time I saw her, her hair was like this. It's almost like the reverse of the wanted poster for a safe slave. And now that same person is being held as someone who's trespassing or loitering because they're, first, they're not working for a white person. That's legitimate work, is working for a white person. And the other side of that is you don't have a job or you're on your way passing through. So it's bad enough the families have been torn apart and you're in search of your family, and now these black codes that have been put in place, specifically, as your son pointed out, to criminalize black behavior. So whatever anyone else was doing, if a person of color, a black person did it, then it could be a crime because they needed that labor. Also to rebuild the South, because when General Sherman came through the South, you know, of course, you know, he burned Atlanta, but he devastated everything. He was a general for the Union Army and said, we're just going to go in and destroy everything possible. So they had to rebuild the South. The 14th Amendment gives black people the right to citizenship at birth, and equal protection due process. But if you go to the last section of the 14th Amendment, people rarely read, and actually it's 1868 for the 14th Amendment, but people rarely read that section. It says the federal government is not going to reimburse the South for any losses that occurred during this war. So remember, Lincoln had already emancipated the slaves in the South. Those slaves, those enslaved people, were of a certain cost. They were collateral. They used to sell off a slave in order to earn extra money. So they then said, we're not going to reimburse you for your lost property in the enslaved Africans, nor are we going to reimburse you for any of the destruction. And General Sherman and the rest of the Union Army is going, now we burn down any home, burn down any cabins where they would kill the cattle. So now the South has lost the enslaved labor they had, but they've also lost, you know, their crops. They would burn the crops. They've lost everything. And so in that 14th Amendment, the fourth stanza, saying we're not going to reimburse anything, in many ways, and I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to see how they justify this, but their mindset is we've got to rebuild. And we found this labor, and we're going to use this labor to rebuild. And so, and as you said before, we go from having, I mean, in the film, a person having the value of this microphone, then having equal rights, voting rights, equal protection, and all the rights we have in a very short period of time. The last thing I wanted to touch on is the way that laws, the federal government attempted to use the law to protect the free Africans in America who now have become African Americans. They passed anti-Ku Klux Klan Act. Because the Ku Klux Klan had started, and Mason Ford, who had been a general in during the Civil War for the Confederate Army, was known for his butchery of African soldiers. So Mason Ford was the one who began the Ku Klux Klan. And if you go back and you find Fort Pillow, and the what happened basically was a battle. And at the end, this battle was one in which the Confederate soldiers overwhelmed the Union soldiers. And when they did, they found these black soldiers who then gave themselves up. They were using, of course, what they thought was the game of war or the rules of war, in which if you are being taken prisoner, you lay down your weapons and you give yourself up, you raise your hand. And when Mason Torres saw that what he had captured were black soldiers in Union uniforms who had actually been firing on his soldiers, he was so irate, he had all of them killed. Now, they claim that just what you might have already studied this, you know, earlier, but they claim that it wasn't, you know, he didn't order them killed, that the soldiers just did it, and he didn't, like, he went to, like, Macy's and came back or something, but, you know, and then they were dead. But they also had, like, a mass burial. So I guess he didn't know about that either. It's an extra holiday sale. So he's gone for a long time. But yes, in Vietnam. So this whole idea of then they try to prosecute him, and once again, they use the law to attempt to do what's right and then lack the moral courage to follow through, as we see with the film. This has happened again and again. And as we go through, by the end, I really want to connect this with the prison industrial complex today. So,
One of the things I found completely frustrating was the fact that the federal government would step up and step back. I mean, as someone who doesn't deals with constitutional law. What does that mean, that the federal government never seems to want to really take the bull by the horns?
Because they're politicians, and they want to be reelected. And as has been pointed out, you know, when Lincoln said, if I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would. So it wasn't that he had a heart of gold, but he was a practical person. And he knew the way this the country was divided in this manner, half enslaved and half not, couldn't survive. And so at the end of the day, he made a very practical political, you know, solution. And the solution was, I'm going to free these particular Africans in the South. That will now undermine the Southern economy, but it would also give soldiers to the Union Army. So it helped both ways. It's a very practical solution to this. And but the concern I have is the change in the political climate when he was assassinated, then Johnson comes in and Johnson wants to appease the South, and that's when we leave, you know, the Africans are basically out vulnerable because we've taken away the soldiers who are protecting them and ending Reconstruction. So we start off early on with the Anti-Ku Klux Klan Act and then the Civil Rights Act. You think of the 1964 Civil Rights Act as the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act began in the 1860s, and they began in the 1860s because the federal government knew the state governments were not going to protect the rights of the free Africans. They knew it. The federal government knew that the sheriffs and the local law enforcement would not protect those rights. They knew the courts would not uphold those rights. So they had an overlay of federal civil rights laws that were put in place to protect blacks who wanted to vote, to protect blacks against oppression and terrorism, against the Ku Klux Klan. They had those provisions placed in there. The concern, once again, is then they lost the political will. Because as the smaller legislation began to enact the Black Code, that led to Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. So when Plessy versus Ferguson happened, and you know the story of Plessy, of course you do. He was an octoroon, Plessy was, Homer Plessy was an octoroon, and he was a civil rights activist in New Orleans. They had civil rights activists before Thurgood Marshall. So he was a civil rights activist back then. And they saw these segregation laws being put in place. They saw these Phoenix things. They saw all these things happen, and they wanted to step up and do something about it. So Plessy decided he was going to board a railroad car that was intrastate. It's it wouldn't be New Jersey, but think of a railroad that's just within the boundaries of the state. And so in boarding that train, he decided he's not going to sit in a designated black section, which was in the front of the train, so all the smoke and the soot from the engine would fly in. They only had a hole in the floor for a toilet. I mean, it was despicable. And the white section was totally different. So he said, I'm going to sit in the white section. Now, he's an octoroon. An octoroon means he's 1/8 black. So he's so light. And it's like some people are like, I'm so light. Yes, but you have to be able to pass for white. And he could. Not just be light. You know, not in your mind, you might look like you think you're almost past the white. You have to be able to actually go to a Klan meeting and not be discovered. Kind of like. So now he sits there, the conductor comes in. Somehow, the history tells different stories. The conductor knew who he was, either by his activism in the community, he knew who he was, and he arrested him. And then Homer Plessy appealed to the arrest, challenging the segregationist law that separates blacks and whites on the railroad cars. He was told not to follow through with this case. He was told of the 9 Supreme Court justices, there weren't enough. You need 5 in order to overturn these laws. But he said, I'm going to do it anyway. He takes the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's where we get separate but equal from that Plessy case. And they decide that they can then segregate by race. They don't have to, but if they want to, they can. And, of course, by then, everybody wanted to. And just to have the effect on voting rights, which I think is very important, because as these people in communities were taken out of the social system, they were also taken away from any ability to vote, to change the politicians who were in place, making the laws, creating the segregationist society. And so from 1896, I believe it was Louisiana, there were over 100,000 registered black voters. over 100,000 by 1900, after Plessy versus Ferguson had been in place, that number was down to a little over 5,000. So once you see how the federal government, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court, which is the federal government, now rules these people don't deserve to be in the same space, the same social setting, and everything's a social setting. This is a social setting that would have to be segregated. A theater is a social setting. Black people had to sit at the top and white, you know, and below. Bathrooms are social settings. Even a cemetery was a social setting. There was a black cemetery and a white cemetery. Yes, and actually that's the last segregated place there is. There are still black morticians and white morticians. And to the point there were black hospitals and white hospitals. Everything was segregated. We think about it, schools and water fountains, but it even had segregated windows. And because what happens, you look out the window and you might say, wow, it looks like it's going to rain. Someone responds, yes, I think so. We've had a social setting. So you can't even look out of the same window at the same time. So when you think about how society was segregated and harsh during that time period, then you can better understand when it comes down to the criminal justice system, how they could treat people in this despicable way. Because even people who were free had and people of color, not just black, but also Native Americans, Asians, Latinos, how people were treated during that time period, you can better understand how they turned a blind eye to the treatment of those people in prison.
But you were going to talk about the setting of, I mean, I think what happened in the 1880s and the 1890s in the South was the beginning with the incubation for the prison industrial.
Definitely.
Yeah,
it was. As a matter of fact, many of you, I'm sure, know about the prison industrial complex and the idea that we have these prisons located in rural communities in which people are worked. They work. They might have made this furniture in here, especially since this is a state college. Because since they work for the state, yes, they make the furniture for the state. And they have other types of jobs they do. Why isn't it peonage? Why isn't it indentured servitude? Why isn't it slavery? What do you think? Because they're paid something. Yes, they're paid like 10 cents a day. So if they're paid something, you're not enslaved. So then that makes the difference. Many of you will have this constitution. And you'll see within the Constitution, it's the U.S. Constitution in African-American context. And in this Constitution, I've highlighted and annotated the places within the Constitution referring directly or indirectly to people of African descent. There are more references to people of African descent in the U.S. Constitution than to any other particular group. The Three-Fifths Clause is in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution. Under the Three-Fifths Clause, we know that people of African descent were counted as three-fifths of a person to determine the number of representatives in U.S. Congress. They were counted as three-fifths of a person to determine the number of representatives in U.S. Congress. Think about it today. And today the issue we have is African Americans and other people who are now sequestered in these rural communities, they're counted in the population of those rural communities. So in being counted in those populations, they then increase the resources to those communities. And in increasing the resources, it gives them political power. Because then they would have more representatives than they normally would have. They would have more state and federal funding.
That's right.
And so we have also...
Well, gerrymandering.
Yes, the gerrymandering. And now there's a mechanism in place where people are attempting to have those prisoners counted in their local communities as opposed to being counted in the prison community. But, you know, of course that's being fought because why would somebody give up that political power? I had a question for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay. What about parole or probation? Did you find anything about people actually having parole or probation when it, you know, when it came to the pianist?
No.
You just in it or you weren't in it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the system was built in such a way that, you know, if you got arrested, like say you were looking for, like John Davis was walking through that town, he gets arrested, you know, someone from the gentleman's farm says, we're going to pay his fine, right? But then John Davis has to pay that fine off. How does he pay it off? He's not, you know, the money that he's making is going to pay off the guy to pay his money. You know, so he never, it took him almost 2 years to get out, from under that system. You could be in there 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you know, it would take you a long time. There's no such thing as parole.
Well, and the Supreme Court, unfortunately, until the 1960s, Supreme Court was on the wrong side of justice many times. And I say this as someone who studies the Supreme Court. As a matter of fact, I cover the Supreme Court now. And the case of Bailey versus Alabama is a 1908 case. And in this 1908 case, we have Mr. Bailey, who signs a labor contract. And in this labor contract, he receives $15 and or $15 worth of goods and services. And then he's being treated like an enslaved person. He decides he wants to quit. So he says, I'm leaving. He doesn't receive the actual money in hand, but they say that he slept in the bed, he ate the food, he had the shelter. There was a value. We put the value at $15. And so he has been incarcerated because he does not fulfill his labor contract. How do I know about this case? Because it's one of the few peonage cases that actually went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this case was decided by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Once again, the Oliver Wendell Holmes, who is supposed to be Mr. Justice himself, he finds in for Alabama. He finds in support of Alabama, and he finds things wrong with the labor contract, but he does not end labor contracts that will end in a criminal sentence if a person does not fulfill the contract. So not only do you have these housing contracts, because you have people, if they live in a housing, in some form of housing, and they can't pay the amount of money, they are then sent to prison, but also the labor contracts that now criminalize somebody who doesn't want to be enslaved.
As a person who's involved in constitutional law, what do you think about the makeup of the court nowadays?
I actually read an article yesterday from someone who wants to have Justice Antonin Scalia impeached. In my book, Race, Law, and American Society, I have photographs, and one of the photographs is of a billboard after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, in which there's a billboard impeach Earl Warren. So this idea of impeaching U.S. Supreme Court justices isn't new. There's only been one justice who's been impeached.
Who was that?
That was, why did you have to ask me? I was just going to say it, and now you ask me, but it's from that.
Okay.
but the idea is that justice is supposed to be objective in many ways, and people are not seeing the U.S. Supreme Court as objective as they should be. I have certain concerns about a court that's comprised of justices who have not practiced criminal law, and yet they are making major decisions around criminal law and criminal justice. And that's a concern. I think perhaps the Supreme Court justices are so sequestered, they don't really understand how their decisions affect day-to-day life. I want to give you two examples. One is the Florence case, and this is a New Jersey case. And some of you may be familiar with the case of Florence versus Burlington County. Of course you are. It's the one in which you have Albert Florence, who was in this car, and he was picked up. Yes, he was, the strip search case. He was picked up for a fine he had already paid, and he was taken to a local Burlington County jail. He was strip searched. This African-American male was actually strip searched twice. He was made not only to shower with delicing powder, but he was also made to squat, to cough, and many of you guys know what I'm talking about, okay, and ways to reveal whether or not he was hiding anything in any of his cavities. And he had to go through this twice for a non-criminal fine. The U.S. Supreme Court was then asked to rule whether or not this was a violation of his Fourth Amendment rights, and the court said no. So now, just like Plessy versus Ferguson, local jurisdictions across the country can strip search anyone who's been detained and put in the general population of their local jail. Anyone, man, woman, or child, may be prisoners. So when I talk about the Supreme Court, what makes me excited about it is the fact that I want other people to watch the court, watch the decisions, and realize that court's decision affects your life. Because at this point, we have the extension of, I have to say it, slave catchers, et cetera, with stop and frisk.
Right.
Yes. So I'd like, you know, from slave catchers to stop and frisk. New book title. Okay? Because when I'm looking at the idea of stop and frisk, it goes back to this sense of we are suspicious of you standing around. We're suspicious of you acting in your own free will, just being able to walk down the street, drive your car, whatever you're doing, you need to be checked. We need to understand that you are not a danger to us. We want to put you in our system, our criminal justice system. If nothing else, put your name in. And the idea of the humiliation, there was an article in the New York Times not too long ago about women who are stopped and frisked by male officers. And their pocketbooks going through. All of this is taking place. For teachers, I would like your students to know, don't wait until it happens to you. Understand that this is happening to other people. If we give people the power to let it happen to people of color, pretty soon it's going to get to the other people as well. Law is not race-based on its face anymore. They might draft a law called the Anti-Terrorist Act, and we're thinking, oh, it's just for people who look a certain way. The law is on the book and can be expanded to be used against anyone. So we have to keep these things in mind that as we consider the U.S. Supreme Court, it's a third co-equal branch of government that has just as much power as the president, just as much power as Congress, and it's only 9 people.
And they're not objective. I don't believe it.
As a matter of fact, a recent poll has indicated only 44% of people believe, believe the Supreme Court is objective. Yeah, they only 44% believe, and that's the lowest rating they've had in the last 25 years.
I don't know if there's a list, but Doug in his research knows of some of the corporations. And, you know, and I think that, you know, some of them are based in Atlanta, like Coca-Cola, you know. Some of the banks in Atlanta, they were, you know, their family descendants were involved in, you know, the penal system. So Doug Blackman knows. He definitely knows, you know.
And then the city government. Because that was another way for city governments to rebuild after the war, and then they liked it and said, we're going to continue this. And so you have these municipalities, and also the interesting part about the descendants, and white and black descendants, is the fact that I've had many people, you know, concerned about my stance on particular issues here and there. But one concern that they've had is the laws that have been put in place, for example, affirmative action that was discussed earlier by the professor. The laws have been put in place like affirmative action. You have immigrants who may say, but my family wasn't here during that time period, so why should I have to deal with affirmative action? You have people talking even about the penis system, you know, but my family didn't do it. But to actually see the descendant of the family and see they're doing pretty well, because they have the inheritance that's been actually given to them over time. What was earned on the backs of those incarcerated men is now the dowry of the great-grandchildren. I don't see them giving anything back. I'm not saying they have to, but I'm looking at this. That's the closest example that you can see of how discrimination has gone through generations and benefited generations who can say, I honestly had nothing to do with this. But you still are benefiting from the system. This is a direct way to look at it. Other ways are much murkier. But this is one direct way for one to see how they have benefited generationally down the line. And there are many, many other ways. But I think it's something that we have to look at. The benefit to some. And as I said, it's like, well, you know, if Brown v. Board of Education in 1954 spoke of this sense of inferiority, that should not have been based on or placed on the shoulders of blacks, it should not have been based in reality, then weren't whites given a false sense of superiority? And if blacks are still carrying this sense of inferiority, are whites still carrying this false sense of superiority? And these are things that we have to wrestle with, not just as teachers, but as you see the young people buying into the system, what do you do? If they buy into a false sense of superiority, and you see some people of color buying into, even like, I teach at John Jay College, so in New York City, I have everybody from all over the world. And I have Asian students who never knew that there was a Chinese Exclusion Act in this country in which Chinese were forbidden from coming to the country, and once they were here, from being citizens.
Right.
So this whole idea of Asians being the model minority, it's like, wow, because you didn't stand up and say something. Well, actually, you did, but they have not taught you the times that Asians, Chinese, and others have stood up, Japanese and others have stood up and protested, nor have they talked about the protests of Native Americans, because they want people to be basically docile and believe that black people are the only ones causing trouble.
Someone has a hand
up. On your point, since there is opportunity for individuals to participate in the system, do you know if any class action or anything filed on behalf of the victims
I think that's an excellent question, and there should be. And I was looking at it from the standpoint, if we can go back to these priests who abused these boys 20, 30 years ago, then why can't we open up these other cases? Why can't we go back, and maybe we can't go all the way back to the 1930s or 1901? Because one thing that I've seen happen time and time again is they say, but that was law. That was the law at the time. Slavery was the law. Escaping from slavery was a crime. So when they say that segregation was the law, so if you fought against segregation, you were breaking the law. I think my concern is that they're going to say that was the law at the time or something like that. But I do think there should be a way to go back and review whether or not we could bring some type of action.
But you need a Rosa Parks or Herman Flex, someone to stand up and do that. Right.
And you have those relatives, so and that evidence. So I think it's interesting. I think our young Harriet Tubmans in the room, our young Frederick Douglasses, our young John Browns in the room, I think it's very important that we understand when we talk about race in different ways that there have always been people who were in the oppressed group standing up for what was right. Always. In my book, Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to present, I go back to the 1600s. And there were people then. There were white people standing up for those people who were enslaved. There were black people standing up for the Native Americans. You know, there are other people standing up for the ages. It wasn't just the people in that group standing up, or we'd never get to this point. There have always been people from other groups standing up as well for what was right. And even if some of them lost heart halfway through or became political cowards, I mean politically afraid, then...
Or a hunk.
Oh, yes.
John Brown.
Yeah, John Brown. Or a hunk. But even when John Brown was facing death, he said this is how he wanted to live his life. He was willing to give his life for that. And I'm not saying people have to give their lives. You don't have to really give your career. You can be weekend warriors. Yes, and think about that. Be a weekend warrior. But at this point, trying to plant that seed of activism in the minds of young people you're teaching, I think it's very important, because young people made big differences in the civil rights movement all the time. Young people made the differences in the movements that changed the country. And moved, I mean, no one person can change the entire country. But as people then work through envisioning what type of country do you want to live in? And what kind of country do you want your grandchildren to live in? And many of you are like, grandchildren? Wait a minute, I don't even have a steady girlfriend. But I think it's very important to envision a country beyond your generation. That's how we got here. The people envision a country beyond their own generation. and we're those people who are the recipients of that, and now it's time for us to envision a country beyond our generation. And these people in Peonage, it breaks our heart, and I think it's something that we owe to them to try to, your film is paying homage to them, but now that we know, we need to do something with the information.
I'm active.
Mm-hmm.
No, it wouldn't break the country. I mean, listen, you know, when the Japanese Americans asked for reparations for those, their family members were in turn during World War II, the federal government decided to pay a certain amount of money to all those interests, it didn't break the country. It wouldn't break the country at all. I mean, it would probably cause major havoc if people if African Americans asked for reparations, but it wouldn't break the country.
Our lessons within our conversations with our students.
So if there's anybody else who has any questions, then I would encourage you to please go through the primary legislatively. You know, expand them. Let's look at that. There are a number of documents. Questions that are there you can begin to use with your kids. Just bring those documents. Let them read them. Let them read the reality and put them against timelines. Because all of them are there. You talk about months apart. You got to document the trees, people, and then you got to document with your mom and tell people if they're on the street, they could be arrested for vagrancy. Where are you supposed to go? Where are you supposed to go? What kind of movement and mobility are we talking about in regards to civil liberties, civil liberties, and freedom? So if you have any questions, we're going to begin to take them.
Thank you. Thank you. My question is part of a two-part question. I guess the first one is the bakery law. This is for the ladies. not part of the bakery law. It reminds us of the current wandering law that exists in New Jersey, which was just replaced with the loitering law. The loitering law was but it was replaced with a wandering law. For example, just entering the road to the town without having a destination. If so, you can be charged with wandering. My next part of my question is, I guess in relation to this, built up by drug population unfairly, the Thousand Feet law, which primarily pertains to mostly urban areas. There's not too many areas that can walk out of a school into the drugs that suffer. And also, part of my question is the labor market. I'm actually taking legitimate jobs that can actually help stimulate the normal economy versus what's happening with the Walton family, who actually own Walmart. Uses some of these, in my term, I still put state labor. If you're making $1.50 an hour for a product that sells $2, all that question. My question was order.
Okay. Well, I think there is a connection between what this society has gotten used to, which is bad things happening to black people, bad things happening to African Americans. And not to, as Stephanie pointed out, not to make it simplistic white-black thing, because I don't see it as that simplistic. I think it has a lot to do with American culture. We are a nation of immigrants. And in my class, my race and law class, I teach as well as my constitutional law classes, I find that one could be in this country as little as 4 or 5 years and yet know what the socio-racial hierarchy is. They know who's on top, who's in the middle, and who's on the bottom. There's no discussion. There's no meeting. We didn't vote on it. Yet you know. And I believe if I asked this group right now, you would know what the socio-racial hierarchy is. And I think this film is so important because it shows us how these laws and the manipulation of the criminal justice system through PNID establish not only in our minds as a country that we should have this socio-racial hierarchy, but why it's important for these particular people to be at the bottom of it, and how it's almost unnatural if they're above us. That it's almost unnatural to have people of color from certain, you know, descendancies to earn more money than European Americans, or to have a better house, or to have a higher title, to have more education.
All those laws, the laws that you mentioned, wandering laws,
reinforce that we are still in control of you. You can have more money, you can have more education, you can have more of these things, but in a way, society has a check that keeps you in that nice car, always second guessing. There is a quote that was made by Klansmen in the 1960s. Basically saying, I'm not going to use the N-word in the quote, but basically saying, we're going to make those people, N-word, fight for every inch they get so that you'll never be comfortable with your success. So if you think it's just your imagination, it's not. that you'll never be comfortable with your success. And he goes back to that thing, the black code, after slavery ended. That you have freedom, but you're never going to be comfortable with your freedom. You're not going to be able to freely walk down the street because we have laws in place that will make you always look over your shoulder, always second guess your freedom. And my concern is we may have some young people who believe freedom is too much trouble. Oh, I said it. You might have some young people who believe it's easier to be incarcerated. Because think about this after slavery. Do they know how to take care of themselves? Do they know how to feed themselves? Do they know how to earn a living? Do they know how to do these things? We don't think so. So we have to now put them in a place where we're still going to take care of them. And we have to keep an eye on them. That's, as you pointed out, how the prison industrial complex was triggered to always keep an eye on these people because now we can't trust them. And one of those questions goes back to, I think someone mentioned it in your film, whether or not people of color, especially African Americans, were going to seek revenge.
Right.
Because the slave catchers and others had laws. The society, jurisdictionally, the society as a whole, but jurisdictionally, they had laws to prevent loitering in groups of black people during slavery because they thought they were going to attempt to escape. That's why those laws were first put in place. You could not have gatherings of black people. In 1831, Nat Turner's revolt, in which he did kill, not he killed one or two white people, but they ended up killing over 55 on a slave area in Southampton, Virginia. And I actually went back and went through that slave area, the same part of the country, a year or so ago. After that 1831 revolt, all the laws changed for the most part to make it impossible for black people to be anywhere on the street alone. Or if they were with a crowd, if they were alone, they had to have a note in their pocket saying why they were there. If they were in any group whatsoever, the group could not be larger than three, and a white person had to be there at all times. And the idea was to keep another revolt. I think the message of that is what we see now with loitering laws, what we see now with stop and frisk. The idea that we can't trust these people. One, perhaps they don't know what to do with their own freedom. Two, they may be up to no good. And it's not just black people. It was young people. I grew up in 19... At a time when they used to stop young people, any race, could not just hang out on the corner. They could not. If you talk to them, some of the young people might talk to their parents. If they were actually in any of the hippie movements or anything like that, they used to arrest them. They were the main ones, you know, who were thought of as the outliers, the people who were suspects. So when you fall into that suspect group, the idea that law enforcement then has to check on you. We have to make sure that you're not causing trouble. We have to make sure we know that you know we see you. And I think it's very important that we understand how these things work. But we also need to understand it might be one group today and another group tomorrow. And that's what concerns me, that sometimes we turn a blind eye when things happen to other people and we think that it's not going to happen to us. We cannot do that. We're a nation of immigrants. We can't just say it's just us and not somebody else because we never know. Once the power gets going, that ball gets rolling, it's going to roll over you next. So we need to understand the same way it's pointed out by the professor that it was the Irish at one point.
Right.
You know, another point it was people were Jewish. Another point, I mean, it was the Italians. This has happened over time. We think, well, now it's Muslims. Like Muslims is a race.
Right.
You know, you can have Muslims as religious, so that could be anybody. So, you know, and then at one point there was Catholic. So we have to understand that we can't let law just run wild, run rampant, because it will run over all of us. We have to have checks and balances. And if we allow these loitering laws to do what it's doing to our young people and other people, then I think that pretty soon it's going to be out of control. And that's when we'll have other people say, I couldn't believe this happened to my son.
I need to, watch your time, because I know you have
Hi, good morning, and thank you. So I have a question, and it has to do with a manner of thinking, helping our students do that kind of thinking that you just talked about. So if they're going to be upstanders, one of the things that was really interesting that the movie used was the term fiendishly rational, talking about this brutal system. So if our students are going to be equally as fiendishly, well, maybe not fiendishly, but certainly rational, so that they can be the upstanders, because obviously the paradigm has shifted. No one is, we're not using the same model, per se. So now we have, as you mentioned, stop and frisk for vagrancy, maybe outsourcing instead of using that standard system. But how do we get our students to spot it, to ask the question, the critical question, and have that instantaneous recognition? This is something that we really need to inspect and inspect further, because they're not going to see the same thing in the same masquerade. They're just going to look a little differently. So how do we get them now to start to question and then to stand up?
Well, I think for me, always the challenge when you're educating young people is to make them question everything in terms of this American country and the notion of capitalism. You know, so they need to understand about, you know, for example, that Apple, that we all these Apple phones that we have, you know, that this Apple makes their money off people who make these phones in all their places for a penny. You know, they need to understand that the coffee that Starbucks makes that sells to us is made by people who in South America who don't make much money. They need to understand that this notion of the economic in this country is based on the backs of people, poor people or people of color. You know, so that they say, oh, maybe I can't go to Starbucks anymore. Maybe I need to understand about where the automobile comes from. They need to understand that there's never just something that's in your hand and you say, oh, it's a great bottle of water, or it's a great bottle of soda, oh, I love my phone. You know, but what does that mean to certain people when you make these things, you know? Because America doesn't. America, you know, we live in a country and a culture here that is always about things. And people will understand that to get these things, there are people around the world who suffer. But you have to make people, just make young people aware and understand that. You got to make people, to me, you have to make people understand that when they read our newspapers or watch our television, you need to understand that what people feed you does not always mean that's correct. Mm-hmm. It's not correct. You have to question. Always have to question. Because if you don't question, you become a zombie. Like many Americans are, oh, black, white, Latino, Asian Americans become, you know, blinded by it. It's like what you were just saying. It's like I get a cab in New York City and an Indian from the Middle East, from South Asia will say, black people are lazy. I swear, we'll say it. Black people are lazy. Why? Because they come to America, and America has ingrained them already within 4 or 5 years about what you were saying. Who's on top, who's on the middle, and who's on the bottom. And you got to challenge all of these things all the time. Your students have to challenge these perceptions.
Yeah, and the idea of identity. This is what is very interesting. I think it was an interesting question to say, well, what is America? What does it mean to be an American? I think within that precept, and I at this point still don't have a correct definition, or I think a proper one, but I think this whole idea of identity is such that what I saw when Gabby Douglas won that gold medal, I thought was unbelievable. That I was so, you know, enraptured with joy, and you know, the other end of the spectrum, people were disappointed that someone else didn't win. She is there on behalf of the country. So the country should be happy. I saw the same thing happen with Serena Williams. And it's like you should be happy the country won, but if your identity is stuck on, I'm supposed to be at the top all the time, and people look like they're supposed to be at the top all the time, then who are these people freaking up? Who are these agents? Who are these other people of color? And someone mentioned before, and getting set for 2045 and 2055, We need to understand that there are people like this very troubled man in Wisconsin who fear the loss of complete identity as people of color then become the majority. So I think we have to start with our young people and get them to understand that who you are inside as a person means so much more. Don't wrap it all around with some statement is one thing you have. That's just one thing. You know, you have talent, you have joy, you have skills and blessings, so many other things you've been given. Statement is one of them. Don't make your whole identity around statement.
So we need to,
I'm going to compliment your film, sir. It's excellent.
Thank you.
It was very good. And I thank you so much, Professor, for I'll give you the context of my question within my school. I'm a high school teacher in North, and my demographics of my class and the whole school is largely Black and Latino in various divisions within those two words. And my question is this, is how do you, and I want your honest opinion on this, of course, how do you show this film or teach on this very subject and not foster students' feelings, particularly maybe African-American students, depending on the classroom, how do you not foster any feelings of distrust, hate, or anger towards, quote-unquote, white people?
I think we're on a continuum. I think it's right and good. I get upset when I watch the Holocaust movie, the Holocaust film, and I'm quite sure people of Jewish descent or people who black and Jews and have to deal with the culture see it as a group of people who were targeted. They were targeted because they looked a certain way, because they had certain last names. And I say the reason why I trip over the people is because some people don't practice their religion. And yet they are grouped over that group too. And so I'm sure when they see those films, they see those movies, and they hear about the destruction took place then, I'm sure it's an emotional thing for them. They have a number of feelings that they have to get through to the other side. And when they show those films later to younger people, those younger people then go through and ask the question, why did this happen to us? Why did they pick up? Why did they do this? I think it's right and it's good for people to feel the pain and go through it and get to the other side. I think one of the problems we have in this country is trying to stifle all these emotions we're not going to feel. We're not going to deal with it. We've never had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on what has happened in this country. We just want to, like, cover it up and keep on going. And we, you know, we're like, oh, we don't want to hurt the feelings of white people, especially white people say, I had nothing to do with it. But I inherited this country and so did you. I didn't do anything, you didn't either. I can't hear this by myself. We're all in this together. And what I tell my students in my Raising the Law class is, this is what we inherited as a country, as a history. And we have to deal with it. Race is like religion is in the Middle East. You know, this is what we have. This is going to be it. It is a chronic disease. And it's just like diabetes. If you don't check the diet and your insulin level, you can get very, very sick. This country needs to check where we are when it comes to race. And we're in a bad place right now. And we're not talking about it. We're not checking it. Those young people need to understand also that many black people stood up and did tremendous things to get no credit for. We're the only people that I know of who rose from this place of despair under law to the highest degree of fame so far, such a short period of time, in the country of their oppression. Other people that go to other countries to find a new way. We did it here, in the country of our own oppression.
I think that's an important thing to say. I mean, I think there's a way to deal with the fact that young people will be angry, is frustrated, is have a dialogue. Have a dialogue. And so they can explore and express their feelings. You know, and maybe by exploring and expressing their feelings, it can channel what she was saying about becoming active. That's the important thing about watching this film. After this film, just don't let it stop with people being angry, just feeling all the energy. Have a dialogue.
Yeah, that's right.
have a dialogue where they can get out, they can understand. They'll have to be angry at all white people. I mean, I work in a lot of these films. I get angry all the time, but I'm not angry at all white people.
Right.
I'm angry at the way that society has established the rules of the movie.
And then also, I wanted to give some active errors, particular things that you do. This is an election year. Work on voter registration. Yes. Work in the community. Volunteer. You know, there are things they can do to say, I want to make this society better. I don't want to sit here and do. We don't want people coming in to somebody so that I'm going to go out and do bad things to myself. I'm going to be self-destructive or I'm going to be destructive to other people because I'm just enraged. I don't need that kind of person because they'll hit me over the head too. They're so blind and angry. They don't know what they're doing. I don't need that person wandering around here. I need someone who's channeling that. Even in my book, I see sometimes when I write about these cases of injustice time and time again, I kind of take a walk around the block and come back to this. And I think that these are the judges, and I have to do it Supreme Court cases. And time and time again, the court has let us down. What the court is doing right now is crazy. Do you know that Chief Justice Roberts is in hiding, they say?
Yeah.
Because he voted the way he felt he should on the health care case. What's going on in this country when it comes to law and abuse and abuse of law? It's something we all have to participate in because I'm going to say this. When it comes to documentation, when it comes to what these young people are going through, because many of them have been stopped 5, 6, 7, 10 times already by the police, already by the time they're 15 years old, we need to understand we're creating little time bombs. So then when they see the film, it's like, what I want them to say is, this didn't start with me. That's too much weight for a young person to have on their shoulder. This didn't start with me. This is a system of injustice, and they need to work to fight against that system and not work to self-destruct or fight any individual person. But there are things that they can do to channel that energy.
Right, well, that's
the question. My story goes on the notion of affirmative action and what Dr. Wilson was talking about, the deconstruction of race. So, in order to stop or in order to not continue this systematic process in which one group gets an advantage over another group, we have to sort of deconstruct this idea of race. We have to eliminate this notion of race. Doesn't affirmative action, which is a seemingly good good policy, hold on to this very notion that we're trying to deconstruct and then eliminate the notions of?
Well, I think that's a great question. Here's where I kind of differ with the professor. I like being black. I do. I like being a person of African descent. I don't see a problem with race, of being racial groups, if that's you want to be in a racial group. I see people denigrating people because they are in a particular racial group is a problem. And that's why I go to this sense of, I had a friend who was black, and I was like, great, love being Scottish, but that doesn't mean you have to denigrate the Irish. If you are into who you are, you don't have to denigrate someone else. And I think that's what's gotten lost, is the idea that we can't be in the group. I'm tall. We're going to admit to be tall people. Then what? What do you want from me? You know, I am a person of color. I enjoy my color. Looks darn good when I'm not as tired. My concern is that I want us to learn how to be our own selves. And that's something we have to learn. It seems like right out of the womb, the first thing we do is start a competition. And then we start the hierarchy. And we have to figure out how we have to be better than someone else. What I like in the Olympics, people are running there. They get there, somebody won because they were the best that particular day. But that doesn't mean all people who came in first that day are going to be the best runners always. And I think we brought into this notion that certain people can always be in the top of the class. Certain people can always be number one. And that's the notion that's tripping us up. Going back to affirmative action, I wrote an op-ed piece for CNN. And In the op-ed piece, I spoke about the issue of affirmative action being an imperative burden for all of us. I cannot be the only one arguing about affirmative action because we see the issues. Now, are we still called for affirmative action because we have to give something up? So we just want leaders to have the burden of history. See, this is where the concern is. This is American history. Why am I the only one carrying the burden of what happened in this film? That's what I want people to think about. The burden should not only be on the shoulders of black people. The burden is an American burden to be spread across. And for people who are immigrants, as I pointed out before, they said, well, I had nothing to do with that. I said, yes, but you are now part of this country. And this is this country's history. If you, his legacy, if you move to Israel, you would have the Israeli history and the Israeli legacy. Whatever country, if you move to India, you would have India's history and India's legacy. If you move to Russia, and so forth and so on. If you move to Russia, you have the history of Gulag. So whatever country you are immigrating into, you can't be in a little bubble that says, the country starts when I got here. You know, the country was in place, it's going to continue to be in place, you get absorbed into it. And you and I inherited this country at birth, you inherited when you arrived. But we all have it. And now what are we going to do about it? How are we going to make it a better place? We can't ignore it by saying affirmative action, it means that that's the birth discrimination, I had nothing to do with it. I didn't either. So we have to decide how we move forward and just saying that racism is going to disappear if I ignore affirmative action. That's not going to do it either. So we have to come up with something better, much better than ignoring affirmative action.
To bring it to a close, I want to thank Lisa Pollard, Kim Pollard, and we'll be playing this on radio. Cast our students as well.
Thank you.